So the abstract was showing for so long, I hope you read it. My talk will follow a handout. Here it is in front of you. I hope you all have copies. If you don't, there are a few more in the back. And thank you for inviting me for this meeting. And the handout and the video and various links will be available soon at this URL. Soon meaning probably even tonight. So I mean, if you ever want to look at it again, you can. And I should say that several excerpts on this page are from Spivak's calculus group, which and I think it's falls under fair use. I mean, I'm not using too much of it. But anyway, here's the cover. It's the Spanish edition because it's much lovelier than the English edition, which is just dull gray. But the book itself is lovely. And here's the table of contents, which is my favorite here. So we start with basic properties of numbers. We end with approximation by polynomial functions, and in fact we don't end, there are three dots here because the table of contents continues. But let me just tell you about some of the things that appear in it and what do I think about them. So, okay, chapter number 6, continuous functions. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. For every epsilon, there is a delta such that if this, then that, and then you prove f and g are continuous, and f plus g are continuous, f plus g is continuous, and f times g is continuous, and things like that. And this is a great intellectual achievement. I mean, the fact that we've been able, the fact that they've been able to put calculus within rigorous context is an amazing achievement, but it's basically the process of turning something obvious into something rigorous. I can say it's my favorite. It's about rigor, right? If you look back at what my specifications were, it should not be about rigor. It should require rigor, but it shouldn't be about rigor, whatever my favorite theorem should be. So, no, that's not that. Then you go on to chapter 7, and the title is Three Hard Theorems. I think they are, I forgot what they are, but one of them is the intermediate value theorem, which is, by the way, my wife's favorite. But I disagree, she's wrong. Okay? So, it says that if you have a continuous function and its value at one place is negative and in another place it's positive, then somewhere in between it's going to have a zero. Oh, come on, you're kidding me. I mean, you know, you're on one side of a line, you want to get to the other side of the line, you have to cross the line. I don't need Spivak to tell me that. Okay? So this theorem is hard and does require proof, but what you're proving when you're proving this theorem is not that the theorem is true, but that your formalism made sense. If you could not prove this theorem using the rigorous definition of a continuous function, you would not be throwing away the theorem, you would be throwing away your definitions. Okay? So that's definitely not a high point of first year analysis. Okay? Then there is this chapter which Spivak calls the significance of the derivative, and it's really about what in my high school was called investigating functions. I don't know what is it called now, what is it called in your college? It's about investigating functions. So, you know, you're given a function x cubed minus x, say, okay? And then there is a cookbook recipe what to do with it. So you write y is equal to x cubed minus x. Y prime is 3x squared minus 1. Well, by whatever means, you figure out where is it positive and negative. In this case, you factorize, you look at the factorization, and you realize that when x is greater than 1/3, it's positive. Out of between some other, in other range, it's negative. In other range, it's positive. Therefore, in some range, it's increasing. In some other range, it's decreasing. Somewhere it's convex, somewhere it's concave, whatever. It has inflection points, I don't know. And then using all of this information taken together, you draw a sketch of the function. Hardly exciting. I mean, everybody hates it, and probably for a reason. And I have to say that, in practice, for most functions that you have to investigate, there are shortcuts that make it much easier. Okay? So if you have some familiarity with what function, what various things look like, so x cubed minus x, then you say to yourself, well, when x is large, x cubed is going to win against x. When x is small, x is going to win against x cubed. So, you know, when x is small, it's going to look like negative x. When x is large, it's going to look like x cubed. And quite immediately, you see that you're forced to have more or less this graph without having to go through the significance of the derivative. So no, that's not my favorite chapter. The next one is chapter 14, the fundamental theorem of calculus. That is an amazing achievement. That is wonderful. That is something truly remarkable and useful, and, you know, I'm not going to make fun of it. You know, if f is integrable and it's the derivative of some other function g, then the integral of f is g of b. The integral of f between a and b is g of b minus g of a. That is an amazing theorem. But we all know it somewhere so well, and I do want to be a little bit original, so I'll move on. And also I'll comment that really this is about telescopic summation. This is really equivalent or practically the same as the theorem about telescopic summation, which is much easier. So it's not really deep analysis. Okay. Chapter 16, pi is irrational. It's in Spivak's book, okay? And this is something that I really loved. I really, really love the fact that pi is irrational. The proof that pi is irrational. So, in fact, I love it so much that at some point, 5.5 years ago or so, somebody put up a challenge of fitting proofs into tweets. And at the time, I think now Twitter allows longer tweets, but at the time tweets were bound to be at most 140 characters. So I took a challenge to write a proof that pi is irrational, which fits within 140 characters. And I opened myself a Twitter account and put it there. And that's the only reason why I had a Twitter account. And in fact, until now, actually, I got a few very negative tweets after some political activity that I was involved in, and I responded. So I have about 3 responses to people telling me that I'm an idiot. And the only tweet I've ever written on my own initiative is this one. Pi is irrational. Let's go over it very, very quickly. Okay? So suppose pi was a over b. Consider the function f of x, which is x to the n times a minus bx to the power n divided by n factorial. where n is large. And then consider v, which is the integral from 0 to pi of f of x times sine of x dx. And clearly, for large n, well, for large n, n factorial is much bigger than the powers that appear here. On the other hand, everything here is positive. That's easy to see. So we're integrating a small quantity. And so the result is strictly between 0 and 1. On the other hand, repeated integration by parts, so f is a polynomial if you look at it. So what you do is you differentiate the f and integrate the sine. But you see, the integral of a sine is what? Cosine? A negative cosine? I don't know. The integral of that is again sine, the integral of that is again cosine, and so on. So basically, what you have here is always the same, sine or cosine. And when you differentiate the polynomial, eventually you'll get to 0. So the only contribution is the boundary terms. And, well, sorry, I'm leaving you an exercise. I'm not actually completing the proof. I'm not actually asserting that the 140 characters here are a complete proof. I'm only asserting that the 140 characters here are enough hints so that what remains is an exercise. So the exercise is the boundary terms that you get when you integrate by parts are always combinations of a and b and sines and cosines of 0 and pi, namely, are always integer. So this integral is an integer, but it's between 0 and 1, and these integers are really scarce, hard to get. So pi is irrational. I think it's an amazing proof. I think it's wonderful. And it fits in 140 characters. The only problem with it is that it's not first-year analysis. Okay? It's lovely. Spivak puts it in his book. In fact, he doesn't put this. He puts a whole chapter, which can be reduced to 140 characters. But it's not first-year analysis. It's way too advanced. So let's move on. The next one is approximation by polynomial functions. So, also known as Taylor's theorem. You all know Taylor's theorem, right? So the claim is, if f is a function that has enough derivatives, then there is a certain, then you can approximate f near x equals to a by a polynomial which we call p of n, or at least Piva calls, p of n sub a of x. And this polynomial has coefficients a0, a1 times x minus a, and so on up to an times x minus a to the power n. And it's really, really clever how you find these coefficients, right? Because you say, suppose that was true, you differentiate both sides, k times or so, and then you compare the kth derivatives at the point x equals a. You've all seen this, right? You've all taught that. We all know this really, really well. And you find that ak is the kth derivative of f at a divided by k factorial. And then the claim is that this polynomial is an extremely good approximation of the function f. Namely, if you look at f minus this polynomial, and then you divide it by x minus a to the n, so you divide it by a very, very small quantity. When x approaches a, x minus a to the power n is a very small quantity. So even if you divide it by a very small quantity, the limit as x goes to 0, to a, is 0. So meaning, which means that these two things are really, really, really close to each other. For example, if you take f to be sine of x and you look at, and you do everything near a equals 0, then the derivatives, the zeroth derivative is sine, the first derivative is cosine, next one is negative sine, negative cosine, sine, and so on. And if you look at it, the even number derivatives are the sines and they are 0 at 0, so the even number coefficients are 0.
The odd number coefficients are, well, the alternating sign, and hence the minus 1 to the k minus 1 over 2 on the, in the denominator, and in the numerator you have the same k factorial that came from here. So let's look at it. So I wrote it in Mathematica. You may know Mathematica. Mathematica is a lovely computer algebra system. And one nice property is that often you can write things in Mathematica to look almost like the mathematics, visually. So this is actually code. And the code here says, let's define ak to be minus 1 to the k minus 1 over 2 divided by k factorial if k is odd, and 0 if k is even. So if it answers yes to the question, an even question. Okay? And then I tell the computer, and that's a bit more like code, I'm afraid, but I tell the computer to plot, well, a table as n goes over 1, 3, 5, and 7, only the odd numbers matter in this case, of sum as k goes from 0 to n of ak x to the n, so basically the first, third, fifth, and seventh Taylor approximation of the function sine, and also plot the function sine itself with different labels, and here's what you get. And here's what we show our students too, and it is a striking picture, because here is sine in blue, looks like a sine wave, I don't know why, and then here is the first Taylor approximation, and it looks like a good approximation, and because you see it's really near, but then here is number 3, and it looks even better, because it matches with the function even longer. And if you look at the number 5, it matches for an even longer range. And if you look at number 7, it matches even better. So the approximations get better and better, and we're very, very happy. But now let's use this to compute sine of 157. Okay? Why 157? Because 157 is MAT 157 is our first year analysis class in which we teach these things. Okay? So let's compute sine of 157. But first, let's compute the individual terms in the Taylor sum. Right? The Taylor series is a sum of individual terms. Let's compute them. So let's compute a sub k, the k, k coefficient, times 157 to the k, where k, I've selected 0, 3, 9, 13, 29, 35, our course numbers, the linear algebra class, the fourth year analysis, a bunch of numbers, okay? What do we get? So when k is equal to 0, the 0th term is 0. When k is equal to 3, so you see 157 cubed is a very large number, and a sub k has a factorial in the denominator, but it's still just 3 factorial, which is practically nothing. What is it? 6? Okay? So you get a very large number as an answer. But since the signs are alternating, it comes with a minus sign here. When k is equal to 9, so basically what happens is that when you increase k, the power of 157 grows bigger and bigger, and 157 is a relatively large number, so you get a larger and larger number, and the denominator is factorial, but factorial catches up with powers only relatively late in the game. So at 157, you get 4.86366 times 10 to the 66. At 223, it's a bit less, 10 to the 61. At 457, by 457, factorials catch up with exponentials, and you're down to small numbers. But then, if you look at the sum as k goes from 0 to 457 of a sub k 157 to the k, you get minus 0.079, which is precisely the numerical value of sine of 157. So good. But let's look at it again. Okay? Let's put these numbers in some perspective. Okay? So here are some sizes of various familiar objects. In units, where 1 is the diameter of a hydrogen atom. Okay? So, by the way, here's an hydrogen atom right here. So, basically, the first of the three dots is a hydrogen atom. And, you know, it's really, really, really tiny. It's only a dot on your handout. And in fact, it's so small that quantum effects begin to play and it looks a bit pixelated. Okay? So this is our basic unit. And then we, and then at k equals 3, we're about the size of a red blood cell. You can only see this shadow here. But even this is really, really tiny. So here's a red blood cell, kind of closer to perspective. And even this is really, really tiny because the term number 9 is more like the CN power. Okay? And term number 13 is roughly the diameter of the rings of Saturn. But even the rings of Saturn are tiny relative to the numbers that we manage here. So here is Saturn, but it's really, really tiny because next, at term number 29, we are the size of the Milky Way galaxy. And then at term number 35, our terms have the size of the whole observable universe. The whole observable universe is, of course, my handout. And then if you move on, you get completely outside of the observable universe looks like a tiny speck in the corner. Okay? And I'm completely out of scale here, because in fact, at term number 157, you're about 30 orders of magnitude bigger than the observable universe. So, you know, if you were to observe it, you wouldn't even see the observable universe. It would be so tiny. Okay? So what's actually happening here? Okay? What is actually happening? So, you start at zero, which is, say, the center of the hydrogen atom. You push to the right by a term which is the size of a molecule. Then you push to the left, back again, with a term which is the size of a red blood cell. And then you push right, left, right, left, right, left, you know, the Milky Way galaxy, the whole observable universe, and eventually the pushes become smaller and smaller once again. And at the end, at term number 457 or so, you fall right within the same atom that you started from, but a little bit off the center at just the right amount to measure sine of 157. That's unbelievable. That's totally impossible. It's just completely, why? Again, the numbers, you know, if you ever tried kicking a football, a soccer ball, you know, you always make a tiny mistake. But you know, Mr. Taylor doesn't make mistakes. It goes all the way to infinity and beyond, and if there was the tiniest mistake anywhere, you wouldn't come back to where you started. Okay? So, you know, here's an example. So here I computed the sum of a to the k, 157 to the k, as an exact number, in fact, and then convert it to a numerical value, and the answer was sine of 157. Suppose I allowed myself to make little mistakes. So instead, let me take the sum of the numerical values, basically decimal approximations, of ak 157 to the k, and sum the approximations as k goes from 0 to 157. The output now is 10 to the 50. So if you make the tiniest mistakes, you're outside of the observable universe in this process. You know, if you want another analog, more from current times, so think about hurricanes. Okay? So hurricanes are like circular storms. So if the storm passes right over your head, then first you get terrible winds going one way, and then terrible winds going the other way. So Taylor's theorem is the analog of the hurricane goes over your head, complete destruction everywhere. You look around you, everything is in ruins. Then the eye passes and the hurricane continues going over your head, but now it's the other side of the hurricane. And then you look outside and everything was brought back to place by the wind going the opposite direction. So it's totally amazing. It's totally amazing, and it's all thanks to Taylor. Except I'm completely lying to you. Okay? I'm totally lying. I'm sorry, it's in my nature. So you see, what we've done so far does not tell you everything that I just said. It only says that when x goes to a, the Taylor's polynomial is a good approximation to the function. And in fact, the bigger n is, the more time you've had to use the whole epsilon delta machinery in the process of deriving this, and so the epsilon and the deltas are smaller, and so the bigger n is, the tinier is the range in which you get excellent approximation. So in fact, this picture is completely misleading. I completely lied to you when I read it out, okay? Really, what you should see here is that polynomial number 1, polynomial number 3, polynomial number 5, and polynomial number 7 become better and better approximation of sine at near zero, but only very, 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 very near zero, where you can't see anything because it's a straight line, or practically a straight line. The difference is too hard to tell. I mean, you know, I can zoom in to the level of individual atoms, and it's not going to help you. You're not going to see that these are better and better approximations. Okay, so the standard kind of obvious way of figuring out the Taylor polynomial actually doesn't tell you that it achieves very much, that it achieves these amazing cancellations. Okay, are you with me? Is this okay? Okay, what?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, good. So now you're allowed to switch to the other side of the handout, because my favorite first-year analysis theorem is actually not the polynomial, the Taylor polynomial, but the remainder formula that tells you what is left, what is the mistake when you compute the polynomial. And the amazing thing is that mistake goes to zero. So let me tell you what the remainder formula says, okay? So it says, okay, if you define the Taylor polynomial as before, and you let R of n and a, so the remainder for the polynomial of order n at the point a, near the point a, at the number x, So you define it to be the original function minus its approximation. So this is precisely the mistake in Taylor's theorem. And then the claim is that there are, well, several lovely formulas for that mistake, and here are two of them. So one formula is R of n a of x is the integral from a to x of the n plus first derivative of the function divided by n factorial times x minus t to the power n. And alternatively, another formula is that R n a of x is for some value, for some number, some specific number t, which is between a and x, it's the n plus first derivative of f at t divided by n plus 1 factorial times x minus a to the power n plus 1. So some of you have taught this recently. Some of you are so well trained in mathematics that they know it. But I'll bet you that most of you, you know, close your eyes, you cannot quote these theorems. Furthermore, I'll bet you that most of you don't know how to prove this theorem, this remainder formula. But these remainder formulas are actually the first time in a calculus class where you say something genuinely amazing and absolutely amazing, incredible, unbelievable. Okay? Why? Because when you see the property of both of these formulas is that they have factorials in the denominator and powers multiplying them, and then maybe derivatives. So basically, if you have a function like sine whose derivatives are controlled, so basically all of the derivatives of sine are of the same size, meaning between plus and minus one. Likewise for e to the x, all of the derivatives are of the same size, in fact they're always the same. So if you have a control, if you have control over the derivatives, then you have powers divided by factorials, and this goes to zero. So the mistake goes to zero. And again, this is an absolutely amazing statement, and it doesn't get the respect that it deserves. So I just told you what is my favorite theorem. Do I need to tell you the proof as well? Maybe I'll do the proof because I still have, I don't know, almost half an hour. Here's one proof. Okay? So I've written the proof in a schematic way in this box. And I think it's actually, once you see it, it's actually very hard to forget it. So it's nice to actually see it. Okay. I want to compute R, the remainder, at a point x, and here is the interval from a to x. So really, when I put R on top of the dot, I mean evaluate R on x. That's equal to, so you know, by the fundamental theorem of calculus, a function evaluated at x is equal to the integral of its derivative. Okay? So, an alternative formula is to pick so I could replace r at x by the integral of r prime on x1, where x1 runs from a to x. I should note, well, that r of a is equal to zero. The remainder term at a, at the point where we're expanding, is zero. And in fact, also the derivative of the remainder term is equal to zero, and the second derivative, and in fact all the way up to the nth derivative of the remainder term, is equal to zero at the point a by design. So, you know, normally the integral of r prime would be r of x minus r of a, but r of a is equal to zero, so I don't need to subtract. Okay? So, but now I have to look at r prime at x1, right? But r prime of x1 is the integral of its derivative. So So it's the integral of r double prime at x2, where x2 runs from a to x1. This is now a double integral. So x1 gets integrated between 0 and a, and x2 is between a and x1. Okay? But in this double integral, the integrand depends only on x2, and you evaluate it, and what it is r double prime at x2. And you simply keep going this way until eventually you find that r of x is equal to the integral of the n plus first derivative of r at some number t, where t is integrated between a and xn, where xn was integrated between a and xn minus 1, where xn and so on, basically multiple integral of this form. Okay? A different way of saying it, and I think it's called Fubini's theorem, it doesn't matter in which order you integrate. A different way of saying it is to say that you sprinkle randomly n plus 1 quantities, t, xn, xn minus 1, and so on up to x1 on the interval between a and x, but retaining their order, right? And then you evaluate the n plus first derivative at t and take the and integrate over all possible ways of sprinkling these quantities. Okay? But you see, here is a different way of writing the same integral. Again, this is Fubini's theorem. So instead of first integrating over x1, then x2, and so on, let me first integrate over t, and then integrate over the remaining variables. But the remaining variables don't even, the integral doesn't even depend on the remaining variables. Okay? So really the only thing that I have to compute is the volume of the object that is n plus, that is basically of the integration domain. Okay? Which is a simplex, but even if I didn't know it was a simplex, I will tell you that if I were to sprinkle x1 up to xn between t and x, the total volume of how this can be done is the length of the interval, so x minus t raised to the power n, because basically I have n variables and each one can run from t to x, if I were to sprinkle them without ordering them. Basically, that would be the domain of integration would be an n-dimensional box, and the volume of an n-dimensional box is x minus t to the n. However, I insist that they will be in this order, x1 here up to xn here, and there are n factorial possible orderings, and all of them have the same weight, all of them are equally likely, so the actual volume is x minus t to the n divided by n factorial. And so, r is equal to the integral as t goes from a to x of the n plus first derivative of f at t multiplied by this factor, and this is exactly formula number one on your handout. And you know, if you didn't like the fact that I did it with hand waving, here is a formula oriented proof. Okay? And by the way, if you don't like multiple integrals, I can get rid of them. Okay? So, you see, I went all the way to the n plus first derivative. By the way, I couldn't go farther because beyond that, the derivatives at a no longer vanish. Right? Rn, the Taylor polynomial was an approximation to the nth derivative. And so, beyond this point, the remainder does not have a zero derivative at zero, so I cannot continue. But I cannot continue, but I could have stopped earlier. So instead of stopping at level n, or at the n of the first derivative, I could have stopped at the kth derivative. And if I had stopped at the kth derivative, I would have an integral of the kth derivative times x minus t to the k minus 1 divided by k minus 1 factorial. Namely, I would find this formula for the remainder. This is not as good a formula, but I could prove it by induction. So the claim is that that for every k between 1 and n plus 1, the remainder term is equal to the integral from a to x of the kth derivative of the remainder multiplied by x minus t to the k minus 1 divided by k minus 1 factorial. You can prove this by integration, by induction. So for k equals to 1, it's just the fundamental theorem of calculus. And if you know it for k, you can derive it using integration by part, by differentiating this and integrating this, and that will give you exactly the next formula of the same kind. And eventually, when you get to the n plus first derivative, then the n plus first derivative of r is simply the n plus first derivative of f, and you recover the old formula, right? Because r and f differ by just a polynomial. So the n plus first derivative will be zero. Okay? So I could have done the same without using Fubini. By the way, here's a picture of Fubini, and if you look at it a bit closer, you see that he's clearly unhappy. I mean, he's I don't know, disappointed. He is seeing how the lovely use of his theorem got replaced by some annoying induction. I mean, I think we owe him something. So let me go outside of what I really wanted to say and tell you about the lovely application of Fubini, which it's besides the point. It's not my favorite first year analysis theorem. But anyway, the fact that partial derivatives commute. So if you have a function, and it's definitely not first year, it's in fact usually second year or so. But anyway, if you have a function on R2, which is twice differentiable with second derivatives continuous near some point, then the derivative with respect to the first variable, then with respect to the second, is the same as the derivative with respect to the second, then with respect to the first. And here is the proof, and again, I'll only show you the schematics. So first of all, choose a very small rectangle around the, or whose lower left corner is the point A. So maybe choose a small x in R2, and the rectangle R will be the rectangle written here, okay, with sides x1 and x2. And then the 1-2 derivative at A is roughly equal to the integral of the 1-2 derivative, right? Because I'm assuming continuity. So the function f1-2 is nearly constant near A, and so the value is nearly equal to the integral. And in fact, I should have written here proportional, because really I'm missing the constant of proportionality, which is the area of the rectangle. Okay, I just dropped it because it's not interesting. But you see, if you have the integral of f1-2, so Fubini tells you that you can integrate on a rectangle by integrating first along the columns, the y variable, and then along the x variable. If you're integrating along the y variable, then you're integrating a derivative, because this is the derivative with respect to the second variable. Okay? And when you integrate a derivative, By the fundamental theorem of calculus, you simply get the function evaluated at the top minus the function evaluated at the bottom. So you have f sub 1, so this integral becomes the integral over the top of f sub 1 minus the integral over the bottom of f sub 1. But that's again a place where you can use the fundamental theorem of calculus. So you are reduced to summing the values of f on, well, the right end of the top interval minus the left end of the top interval and minus the right end at the, sorry, the value at the low, the right end of the lower interval plus the left, sorry, I'm getting confused, it's late. But anyway, if you get this summation of values of f, but that summation is exactly the same summation that you would get if you would start in the other side. If you start with f2,1. So therefore, f2,1 at a is approximately equal to f1,2 at a, but the approximation gets better and better when x gets smaller and smaller. And so take the limit as x goes to 0 and you find that partial derivatives commute and we've made Fubini happy again. I hope, I don't know. Anyway, I actually do want to tell you about a second proof of the Taylor's remainder theorem. So here it is. So I want to prove the second form of the remainder theorem. So, of the remainder formula. So, there exists some t between a and x such that the remainder at x is equal to the n plus first derivative at t divided by n plus 1 factorial multiplied by x minus a to the n plus 1. And again, you're welcome to think it's a dreary formula. In fact, I believe you thought that until now. But let me remind you again. It's the first amazing formula in calculus. So it's not very. Anyway, I need, in order to prove it, I need a variant of the mean value theorem. So let me call it the mean value theorem for curves. The mean value theorem for curves, well, here's the precise formulation. If you have gamma, a curve defined on an interval AB with values in R2, so basically gamma is either this green line or maybe this red line here, and it starts at gamma of A and ends at gamma of B, and I'm saying smooth because I don't want to care about how many derivatives I want it, and it has infinitely many derivatives, that's not the issue. But you can, of course, be more specific about how many derivatives are necessary. So if gamma is a smooth curve, then I claim that there is some number t1 in the interval between a and b such that the tangent to the curve at that t1, sorry, this should be t1, not t, so the tangent to the curve at t1 and the overall vector going from the beginning point to the end point are linearly dependent, which roughly means proportional, but not quite, okay? So, in picture, what I'm trying to tell you is that if you draw the line from the beginning point to the end point, there will be some point on the curve such that the tangent to the curve at that point will be parallel to the vector between the beginning and the end point. And by the way, it's slightly amusing. I mean, you might think that you might think that it's obvious because, you know, if you go from here to here, at some point you must face, you know, if you walk from gamma of A to gamma of B, at some point you must face in the direction that you're going. Okay? Right? So, I mean, if I walk towards Kostya, right, then, you know, I at some point must face in his direction. But that's actually false, because I could walk, and instead of facing him, I could do a 270 degrees and then continue towards him, like this curve does. Okay, so in fact, the curve, the red curve here, the tangent to the red curve is never pointing in the direction of the vector from gamma A to gamma B. But at some point, it is pointing in exactly the opposite direction. So really, so it's a little bit tricky. The theorem is not saying that at some point the tangent must be the direction of walking. It's either the direction you walk or the opposite. Okay? Anyway, why is it true? I mean, after saying so much, it's actually very, very easy. So you pick a normal vector to the path, to the vector from gamma A to gamma B, you call it V, and you look at the inner product of this normal vector with the tangent to your path, be it the green or the red. Now, that inner product must have a maximal value at some point, and at that point, the derivative, so I look at the inner product, sorry, what did I say? The inner product of V with the tangent, I mean, what did I mean to say? Basically, you look at the inner product of V with the I want to measure how far you've gone. You know, you basically measure how far your curve is from the line from gamma of A to gamma of B by computing some inner product. Okay? At some point, you get maximally far from the line from gamma A to gamma B, and at that point, your curve must be. The tangent to your curve must be parallel to the line from gamma A to gamma B. Okay? And at that point, that is the point in which gamma B minus gamma A and gamma dot are linearly dependent. Anyway, if you're lucky, you have a little bit more, and namely, if you write the curve as a pair of functions, psi and eta, and if eta is not equal to zero, and else also eta dot is not equal to zero, then saying that psi eta is linearly dependent with psi dot eta dot is the same as saying that the right ratio of psi and eta is equal to the ratio of psi dot and eta dot, which is the same as saying that psi b divided by eta of b, oh sorry, and if furthermore gamma at the point A is equal to zero, if I start at zero, then saying that the two vectors are linearly dependent is the same as saying that psi b over eta b is equal to eta dot, so to psi dot at t divided by eta dot at t. And if you're lucky, you can iterate this. So if you're lucky, this is also, so what does lucky mean? Lucky just means that this should also vanish at a, and on the other hand, it should not vanish elsewhere. And eta double dot should also not vanish on the open interval. So basically, if the right-hand side makes sense, then you can continue. You can say that psi dot divided by eta dot is going to be equal to psi double dot divided by eta double dot at some point t2, which is between a and t1, and so on. And by the way, this is what lies behind L'Hopital's rule. So if B approaches A, the ratio of psi, the limit of psi b over eta b is equal to the limit of psi dot divided by eta dot, which is exactly L'Hopital's rule. Anyway, so sorry, maybe I spent too much time and maybe I'm a bit, maybe it's a bit late and I'm a bit confused and it wasn't the greatest presentation, but that is the mean value theorem for curves. Now that we know it, what remains is a triviality. So you look at the remainder term for Taylor's theorem, divided by x minus a over n plus 1, to the power n plus 1, all the conditions are satisfied, and so there exists some point t1 for which you can replace this ratio by the ratio of derivatives, which is written here. I guess this x should have been t1, not x, sorry. But then you can do it again and again and again and again. And when you do it n plus 1 times, you reach the n plus first derivative at t to the n plus 1 divided by, this term gets repeatedly differentiated until it disappears, and you're simply left with n plus 1 factorial. But you see the n plus first derivative is equal to, of the remainder, is equal to the n plus first derivative of the function, and hence you got the formula written here. And now if you move the x minus a to the n plus 1 from this side to this side, you get the remainder formula. Sorry, I feel I had too much food and it didn't feel convincing. But in fact, hopefully you'll take your time and look at it a little bit and convince yourself that it's actually right. And if it was all very boring, then at least you've seen the easiest proof that pi is irrational. So this is actually from 10 years before. 10 years before, I had the ambition of writing the proof that pi is irrational on the back of an envelope. That was before Twitter existed. So in fact, I wrote it on the back of a CD case instead of an envelope. And it's a little bit it has a little bit more detail. So if you couldn't solve the exercise, here's the solution. And I should say that I actually found this proof myself following hints in Spivak. But after that, I found that the exact same proof was found in 1947 already. Thanks for listening to me, and that's all.
Any questions? Tomorrow maybe test.
I taught 157 long ago, yeah.
So you know what sort of your favorite theorem is, but what do the students think of also? What do they like the best, or are they as equally impressed with this?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, you have to poll and see what they say. I don't know.
Any other hot questions?
Yes.
So, despite the fact that I've used it a lot, I don't think I've ever actually seen a proof of L'Hopital's rule. Is this the canonical, is this a commonly used proof, or is this?
I don't know if it's a commonly used proof.
Okay.
It's a proof.
Okay.
I'm not sure what else. Sure. I'm not sure. I mean, usually, okay. So, you know, calculus books and calculus teachers tend to hide things. Okay, so I genuinely think this is the correct proof of the integral formula. I mean, you basically follow your, you know, you basically replace the remainder by the integral of its derivative, then the integral of the integral of its second derivative, and so on, and it comes out, okay? However, this requires, in fact, even when I tried to explain it to you, I got a little bit confused. So it's very, very tempting to switch to saying, let me prove the following formula by induction. And that's very, very easy. The problem is, where did this come from? Okay? How on earth would you have guessed this? It's completely counterintuitive. I mean, A minus T makes sense. But x minus t, it's like going from the wrong end of the interval. And why would you guess this formula? So once you guess it, the proof is with integration by part, and it's very, very easy. So in a similar way, I think people will have some aversion to the mean value theorem for curves because it requires the plane, and we're doing single variable calculus. Okay? So probably the books will give you different proofs of L'Hopital, where this is somehow hidden. But I think this is one of the lovelier proofs, even though I admit I got confused on the way and blame the hour. Yes?
Your proof is actually, that is the standard proof of
L'Hopital's
theorem?
Yeah.
You can derive that using the mean value theorem, the single variable mean value theorem?
Yes.
So the interpretation as a curve can count separately, but you can do it entirely within the single variables, and that's literally the standard proof.
Yeah.
If you replace it with approximation, it's fairly natural why you would do this, so it is the standard proof.
Okay, I believe you.
Well, it's getting late, I believe, and I think we should thank our speaker again. But before you go, it will be some announcement made, right? No, let's thank our speaker first.
Hello,